This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. We're taking a look at large animal veterinary medicine today. And back with us is Dr. Alexa Burton. She is a clinical assistant professor at UW Veterinary Care Large Animal Hospital. Dr. Burton specializes in large animal medicine, critical care, and equine geriatric medicine. Do you care for a large animal, or are you thinking of getting one? Well, we'd like to hear from you with your questions. Join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Oh, welcome back, Dr. Burton. It's good to see you.
And you too, Jill. Thank you for having me on the show again. It's great to be here.
Absolutely.
I had a blast last time, and hopefully it'll be the same again.
Well, hopefully you get lots of questions from people. And, you know, I've always been curious. When you specialize in large animal, when you go to veterinary school and you specialize in large animals, do you have to do that from the very start, or is that something that you decide on as you're learning?
No, it's something you decide on as you're learning. So you, all students study all species at most universities. There are a few in the USA where they're starting to specialize in school. But when I went through, we had to do everything. And I will admit freely that I dreaded my time in the dog and cat wards. Mainly, I love cats, but I don't really like dogs so much. And so that was a terrifying time for me. And my compatriots, when they came into the large animal area, they kind of felt the same. So I did everything and then started to specialize when I finished veterinary school.
Okay, so you have to do additional training then after you get your regular degree.
Yes.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, quite a lot.
So yeah, because it must take a lot longer. You've got way more animals to consider, right? What are considered large animals?
I guess, you know, that's an interesting question, because I recently was helping a friend, one of my friends in South Africa, was sending me a rhino ultrasound that he was doing, just to, you know, ultrasound. And apparently, I did not know this, but rhinos have a very similar digestive system to horses. So that's how that all came about.
Okay.
But large animals that I treat and are conventional in the US would be horses, cattle, and those are the main two at Wisconsin. Then we've got small ruminants, and those are goats and sheep, and then we have pigs too. And pigs are divided into pet pigs and production pigs, and we very much deal with the pet pigs. They tend to be Vietnamese potbelly pigs or teacup pigs, things like that, special breeds. And I have seen the occasional reindeer and antelope at UW, but that's not normal. Large animals, really.
Okay. And what about like llamas and alpacas and that?
Yes, I completely forgot them. And I don't know why, because I really, really like them. We don't see too many of them, but they, you mentioned further training. I did a residency at Cornell, and we saw a lot of, it was back in the early 2000s, and we saw a lot of alpacas and llamas because there was a countrywide boom. And I was very wary of them to start with. I'd never touched one, but after 3 years, they're wonderful. They're having a little bit of a comeback. They're fiber animals. So they are produced for their, you know, fleeces, which are shorn, and they've got very, very nice coveted fiber, and they're great to work with. I really, really like them. And one point I will make, the challenge with being the sort of large animal veterinarian that I am is a large animal, a baby pygmy goat, maybe weighs 2 pounds, if that. And then you've got an adult draft horse that weighs over 2,000 pounds. And so you're dealing with a huge scale of size, even though they're all technically large. if that makes sense.
Yes, it totally makes sense, because that's very, very true. That's why I asked, because, you know, there are some awfully big Great Danes out there that could be considered a large animal. So, right. Now, I've heard in the past, and I'm not quite sure how that is right now, but do we have enough large animal veterinarians?
It's an interesting question that. So there is becoming a scarcity of large animal veterinarians, particularly equine ambulatory. And so that's equine veterinarians that go out in their trucks and they drive from farm to farm. And there's a scarcity over the last couple of years in the US, but also in Europe and the UK too. So we do need more large animal veterinarians. However, the downsides to being a large animal ambulatory veterinarian are not that dissimilar to the things that you see on James Herriot. So, you know, freezing, getting really hot, not enough water, not enough help, things like that, challenges, long distances to drive for one call. And so it's a challenging field to be in, and there is a shortage right now.
I would think so. It's a difficult job in any case, and to have to do it in those kind of circumstances. And it's physically demanding, isn't it?
Yes, it is. So there are techniques to a lot of, you know, a lot of things. You don't have to be, you know, a particularly big or tall person. And when I was in veterinary school, I remember vividly one method of anesthetizing, you know, cattle is to cast them with a rope after sedation. And so you put ropes around them. And in the class, they used to, you know, as 80 of us in the class, they used to get the, you know, the smallest members of the class who were small animal oriented and have them do the casting, you know, just to its technique. You do need to have a certain amount of strength and fitness. And that's, you know, that's healthy, as that's a healthy lifestyle to live anyway. But as long as you have base strength and cardiovascular fitness, it doesn't matter. The other things don't really matter. It doesn't matter if you're the smallest person in the world or the tallest person in the world. You can utilize your own body and physical forces to help you. So physics, really.
Sure, and that makes sense, because nurses and CNAs kind of do the same thing when they move around patients. So, now tell us about the UW Veterinary Care Large Animal Hospital. It's located on the campus for UW-Madison, right? What kind of things go on there?
Oh, so that's an excellent question. So right now we're undergoing a remodel. So we're building a new hospital, and it's being built around the old hospital. So that's been kind of interesting, but doable. And so the aim is we're going to have more stalls. And the biggest plus is a big arena that we will have. So that will be useful for lameness evaluations and things like that. And we have the standing CT. The things that we do there, in my section, large animal medicine, we do a lot of emergency and critical care on predominantly cattle, horses, but also the neonates of those species, so calves and foals. And this year has been a very, very, very busy foaling season. I'm not sure why. Normally in Wisconsin, the last 2 years I've been here, the foals start right at the end of March. This year, the first one came in the middle of January, and they haven't stopped coming. And so they're fun, and they are quite labor intensive, but can be very, very rewarding.
I would think so. Yes, definitely. Yeah. So the new building itself, or I'm sorry, when people come in with their animals, do they have to make appointments? Do they just kind of come in? It sounds like some of these could be emergencies if you're talking about foaling.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So we do have appointments, and appointments are for non-emergent things, but quite often we'll have people calling in. It'll either be a referring veterinarian, so that's a veterinarian in the field who's seen, you know, the animal and says, this, you know, they need to come to you for intensive care, or a client calling in, you know, especially if they've been here before or not. And if it's an emergency, unless we are literally full and have nowhere to put them, then that's what we, you know, we do. So emergency calls, the luxury that we have as opposed to James Herriot is that they, for the large animals, they come to us. And we have oxygen and we have fluids and equipment, padded stalls, hoists. We have a float tank for down cows that have also need IV fluids at the same time and critical care. So that's what we do. And we have a team of doctors on the medicine side, on the surgery side, and very, very skilled and talented technicians who've been here for a long, long time. And then, of course, our fourth year students who are part of the team. And they're learning, but they're also a huge part of the team and the learning experience.
Must be fascinating. Is there any real life TV that covers that kind of stuff? Because I would think that would be fun to watch.
Yeah. So they did this show about 15 years ago in England called Vet School.
Okay.
Where it was a huge hit at the time, and they followed fourth year students or their fifth years in England through their final year, and they had to commit to being followed through their final year, which they've had five of them. And it must have been daunting at the time, but I think three of those five went on to become big stars. So
wow,
there was more than there is now. Now we do have, you know, there's a huge issue that we're always mindful of. And with the human medical shows too, I think it's somewhat even more important is patient confidentiality, because we have stalls next to each other. And even if someone said, "Oh, it's fine for my horse to be on TV," you know, whilst you're treating them, that's a huge issue. And with social media as well, we're very, very, very strict about, you absolutely cannot take photos of your animals and post them on social media with respect to the people that work here and with respect to the students, because that's really important. It needs to be a place that, the client can bring their animal and feel safe, and the animals feel safe. And when they're not well, the animals, that creates challenges. You know, if it was it would be very marketable for TV, but when you really start to pick it apart, I think it was very challenging to get right.
I would think so. We're talking about large animal care, and this is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Clara Neipert is our on-air producer today, and Trina LaSousa is our technical director. We're talking about caring for large animals with Dr. Alexa Burton. She is a clinical assistant professor at UW Veterinary Care Large Animal Hospital. Join in by calling 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email, and that's ideas@wpr.org. Now, you shared with me, Dr. Burton, that you've been doing some fascinating research on the horses that were in battle during World War I and how they were cared for. What got you interested in that particular time frame?
So that's a great question. It was around it was 2018. And so it was I was in England at the time, and there were a lot of sort of media and publicization of the end of World War I. And a statistic was posted that 80% of horses treated in World War I were cured and returned to duty. And I thought, really, because at that time antibiotics had not been invented. They were invented in the middle of World War II. So that's 1942 they were invented, penicillin. So I thought to myself, how on earth could that be possible? Is that statistic true? And so I started to investigate, and I went down to the military barracks in Aldershot, and the Museum of Military Medicine, and looked in their archives. And I started to undig a lot of fascinating information that statistic is true. They had anesthetics and they had painkillers, and the same treatment was used for the horses as was used for the soldiers, and it was a similar setup. They were treated, you know, they were very important, and they tried to save them at all costs, even going as far as having rehabilitation hospitals for them, which would take 2,000 horses at a time. And a big part of the rehabilitation was rest and grass and fresh air. But the numbers of horses treated were astounding. By the end of the First World War, they had 50 hospitals in France. Each could take up to 2,000 sick horses. And they performed surgeries such as removing shrapnel and bullets, treating infections. And they did it all with no antibiotics. So that was pretty fascinating. And some of the resources I came across were handwritten diaries from veterinary soldiers in First World War that had not, I was the first person to read them for 100 years, and they wrote every single day about their, you know, their ward duties, what happened, what surgeries they did, and then about everything that was going on. And so it was very magical reading those diaries, and it really was astounding how much their feelings, you know. I'm a female in the 21st century, but you know, the veterinary officers' feelings were so similar to a lot of the feelings that we have today. And some things have really not changed that much, and that is what struck me quite a lot. And the success rate was phenomenal, really.
That is, I would never have believed that myself. When you consider what the fatality rate was for the people, the men that were fighting at that point too, that's amazing. And they were so important to what they were doing over there at the time. Without the horses, they really couldn't have done a lot of the things they did do, right?
Yeah, that's correct. The horses were used a lot for hauling, for pulling across terrain where motor vehicles couldn't go, because it was in a crossover period where motor cars were just coming in, and horses were being phased out for transport. But in the muddy fields, there were areas that only horses could go across, or you could go by foot. And so that's what they were used for a lot. And then the animals became very, very important to the soldiers that looked after them. In general, one soldier looked after two horses, and the soldier prior to joining didn't necessarily have any animal experience, any horse experience. They had a little pamphlet that taught them the basics, and they took care of those two horses, and they became very, very, those horses became an extremely important part of that soldier's life when they were in such horrible conditions together. And if they lost one or both of those horses, it was devastating to them. They also had, you know, canine mascots and working dogs too. But the human animal bond was very important at that time. And so that was, you know, that's the same now.
Certainly is. Yeah. We've certainly found that out during this whole pandemic where we've been at home and our animals have sort of made things a little bit better. So for sure. Yeah. And now you're going to be writing a paper, I believe, publishing a paper on your research. Is that correct?
Yes. So yes, I am going to be publishing a paper. It got put on hold a little bit during COVID. I couldn't go back to the UK for 2.5 years. And so I needed to go back to the museum, and then we became very, very busy in the clinic, like doing clinical work that, you know, sort of saving animals' lives. But it is something that will be published. I presented it in 2019 at a conference, but I think it's an important story that needs to be told. And I intend to publish it soon.
Absolutely. Well, wonderful. Well, let's go to the phones. We've had a couple of people with some questions here. Ellen in Neosho is first. Hi, Ellen. What questions do you have for us?
Good morning, Jill, to you and guest. I'm enjoying the conversation this morning. I'm noticing kind of a change in the parasites, the biting insects specifically. My horses, and in the past, you know, there have been some flies and mosquitoes and so on that, yes, they bite, they're sort of a nuisance, but they don't leave terribly big lesions that take a very long time to heal. And I'm seeing a kind of a shift in the types of parasites that are biting that leave bigger wounds and take longer to heal and really seem to bother the animals. I'm wondering if the doctor has seen this change in the types of species of biting insects that are attacking horses and can shed some light on what they are and what we can do to make our animals more comfortable.
Great. Thank you for that question, Ellen. Dr. Burton, are you seeing more of that?
Unfortunately, I suspected it was going to happen. We're up here, it's quite hot up here, and I do think, I hate to, you know, use a catchphrase, but I think it's an effect of global warming and species moving around, and they produce maps every year of West Nile, Tripoli, Venezuelan, Western encephalitis, and the states being affected are increasing every year. These are from the USDA, and they lag 2 years behind, but every year there's been an increase across the USA. And it's not just the insects, you know, biting horses, they also affect people and dogs as well. With respect to how to control them, that's a tricky one. Unfortunately, I spent 4 years working in Georgia, and I found, you know, obviously there are a lot of large insects down in Georgia. It's very hot and it's very, very wet down there. But I found that the only things that really worked for the horses down there were the most potent fly sprays, which tend to be also the ones that are potentially toxic if they build up in the pastures and toxic to other insects. So it's a difficult balance. If you have a particular horse who is more affected than others, you know, using a very potent fly spray is a good way forward to protect that horse. But I agree with you that I think we're going to keep seeing an increase. And this is a fact that you probably maybe don't want to know, but I think it's relevant. When I lived in Georgia for those 4 years, all apartment complexes were mandated to have anti-pesticides sprayed all inside them every 6 months, no matter what you wanted, because the pests were so bad. Now, that law is not in force in Wisconsin, nor is it in New York, but recently it's coming to the point where it maybe should be a law, because I do think you're right. I think that they're increasing and they're going to increase. I don't know if that's very helpful to you or not.
But it's background, so yeah. Well, sorry about that, what's going on with your horses, Ellen, but thank you for bringing that up. It's good information for us to know and for people who have horses, for sure, and other animals. Let's go next to Pat in Mukwonago. Hi, Pat.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to thank you wholeheartedly for what you did for my horse twice over the last 5 years or so. The University of Wisconsin at Madison is a phenomenal facility, and you deserve all the praise that you're getting. Further to the previous caller, what's your feeling about feeding systemic bug deterrents, such as garlic and things like that? I have a horse that doesn't tolerate any of the sprays, and it doesn't help that she's dark-coated and thin-skinned. So while I'm standing right here next to her, I'm already looking at the flies on her. Do you have any ideas?
So, Pat, thank you for your kind words. It's very nice to hear. And I'm sorry that you have a horse that is not tolerating the bugs. You just you spring something into my mind then that I haven't thought about here, but in the UK, a lot of the fly sprays that, for example, I was talking about in Georgia are illegal because they're toxic. And so what they do in the UK is they use, for horses that are very affected, they use fly sheets, and they are body fly sheets. So they cover them from their neck to their head, to their ears, and there's even a belly band. And some of them have markings on them like a zebra. So that, in theory, detracts the flies away. And so for the years I was in England, that's what a lot of people were doing, would be the full body fly sheets. And I believe that if you look on Dover or a similar tack store, you might be able to find a fly sheet, and that may help, especially with the horse being dark. With respect to the in supplements to feed, I don't know which would truly work. They say that garlic does help, and I don't see why it wouldn't. I don't think there is any harm in trying it, but I would go try a sheet, and a sheet that has a pattern on it, so it kind of did make, because the reason that zebras are colored the way they are is to, they've evolved like that to keep the flies away from them, and so they're more camouflaged, and so that's why they've made the fly sheets with zebra or cheetah patterns on them.
Very interesting. Well, try that out, Pat. I'd love to hear how it works. Send us a picture. That would be cool. Thank you for the call. I appreciate that. Lisa in Crivets. Hi, Lisa.
Hello. When I was very young, we moved constantly. So I grew up very isolated. You know, I didn't make friends a lot because I knew we weren't going to be staying in one spot. We moved every 3 to 6 months sometimes. But when I got a little bit older, we kind of settled down, and I got a horse. But I was so isolated, I suffered horribly from depression. And I used to go to the stables, and I would lay on my horse. I would literally go to sleep laying on her back. And I would talk to her, and she would follow me around like a little dog. I was so depressed. If I had not had that horse, I don't think I would be here now. I mean, she was my life for a number of years.
Oh, that's amazing, Lisa. Thank you. Dr. Burton, you've probably heard stories similar to that before, haven't you?
Not only have I heard them similar, Lisa, I'm so thankful that you found that horse, because I know what that's, and thank you for sharing as well, because you know, the same thing has happened to me. I had a mare, horse of my lifetime. And in fact, she passed away 11 months ago. And I, I can't bring myself to get on another horse. I love horses, but I do know what that's like. And I think that's, you know, similar to what the soldiers felt in battle. They'd lost friends, they were alone, they're away from home, and horses are very special, and there are horses that you connect with, and they are so important. And so I'm really pleased for you, and thank you for sharing that.
Thank you, Lisa. Let's go on to Victoria in Menominee, Michigan. Hi, Victoria. What's your question?
Hi. I have a horse that's purebred Arabian, and my farrier thinks she may have DSLD. And I was wondering if the vet had any suggestions on how to treat her, or any latest research on that progressive disease.
Thank you, Victoria. What's DSLD before we go even any further? Do we know? No? Okay. I was just curious. So what does that involve?
Disease.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Burton. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't, you know, that would be something. If farriers, I found that farriers are very, very good at what they do. And my focus is more on the medicine. I've moved away from, lameness issues. And so I'm sorry, but I can't really offer any specific advice on that problem.
Okay, well, thank you, Victoria, and good luck with finding some help. Are there specialists at the vet clinic here that could probably help her out?
Yes, we do have, so any one of our surgeons from the surgery department, and we also have a farrier here who comes every Thursday usually, and so that, is something that they could definitely, need to evaluate the horse. Need not be very expensive to start with, and go from there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Thank you for that. If you've got a question, give us a call. We have open lines, 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email, and that address is ideas@wpr.org. And we did get an email from Terry in Roberts, and she's asking if you have ever spayed or fixed a mare, or at least seen it done? And if so, will it help behavioral change if the mare is really quiet when not in heat? And can it cause bone density loss?
Oh, so that's a good question about the bone density loss. So personally, I've never done it, but I have seen it done, and it's usually laparoscopic. It's not something to be undertaken that lightly. But, you essentially make the mare, as a gelding. So things to consider would be, obviously they have to have a surgery, and there are other ways. So Regimate is a drug that you can give, which is a hormone, just like people taking the pill almost, that can control them if they have bad heat cycles and are very, very naughty in between. But some people will go as far as doing a spay, as it were. The only difference to spaying a dog in reality is it's a much greater risk surgery, because you have to do it standing, and there's a higher risk of complications. The other thing to take into account is that geldings, male horses that have been castrated, they're not as intelligent and they're not as quick as stallions and mares. So mares and stallions intact are smarter and they're quicker. And so that's why they are very good at things like show jumping and polo, where they're required to, and dressage, where they're required to be hyper intelligent, very quick thinking. So if there's things about your mare's personality that you like in between times, it might change. And so that's something to bear in mind, and it might change permanently.
Wow, so. Lots to consider. Good luck, Terry. Again, if you have a question, comment, always wanted to know about being a veterinarian, give us a call, 800-642-1234. So as you were mentioning before, lots of babies are being born at this time of the year and, you know, a few months back. What kind of problems are pretty common as far as for the foals, for the mares and for the foals?
So one of the most common problems that we see, it's commonly known as dummy foal syndrome, which isn't very polite, but the full name is hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy, which is probably why dummy foal syndrome rolls off the tongue more easily. And it basically means that they suffer at some kind of hypoxic event during birth, just before birth. Can be triggered by a minor illness in the mare a few weeks before they give birth. And it results in the foal for a few days not really knowing. They're born, a normal foal is born and knows how to get up and nurse. And so these foals, they don't know really how to nurse. And so may get up, they may try nursing from the mare's knee or the mare's tail. They really don't get it. And in very, very quickly, that runs into problems because it means they don't get their colostrum, which is needed for immunity, and they also don't get nutrition and they don't get hydration. So then they become very, very sick with infection. So that's the knock-on problem. The other important thing to say about the dummy foals is sometimes a certain subset of them can be born normally. They get up, they nurse, they're fine for a couple of days, then the symptoms onset. And those are slightly trickier because they're harder to catch immediately. And so those are the most common things we see with the newborn foals. And they need supporting until they recover, which requires feeding from a feeding tube every 2 hours. It's an indwelling thin feeding tube. So feeding, making sure they're hydrated, and providing them with nutrients and covering them against infection and giving them a plasma transfusion so they get antibodies that they would normally get from their mother, but they missed out on. And they usually recover, average is about 5 days, and they suddenly learn how to drink. And it is very sudden often. They spend ages and then the light bulb goes off and they learn how to suckle, and then they're away. That said, they can, with that lack of immunity and dehydration, they can get very ill very quickly. So those foals, we like to see them sooner rather than later. But they have a good prognosis long term. It doesn't seem to affect their performance long term or their cognitive abilities when they're adults that we can assess.
Mm-hmm. So is it important? I mean, how do you know this is going to happen? You don't, it's a surprise. So it's important to have like a trained professional there when the foal is being born?
Not necessarily. If there's someone that has foals out a lot of mares, it's important to have advice. Sometimes, one factor is you don't necessarily know when the mare is going to foal because they have a very long gestation of 11 months and they can kind of go 2 or 3 weeks either side of that depending on the mare. And so one big thing that most owners have these days is a foaling camera. And so to be able to watch on the camera to make sure things are progressing as they should, and watch for the signs. So a lot of them that have come this season, the signs that they've seen have been, that they saw on the camera have been explained, and the advantage, and they've recognized the, you know, the lack of nursing, wandering around, snapping, you know, kind of snapping at the air with their mouth. And the advantage of a camera over physically observing them is you are less likely to put the mare off. So it's better for the maternal bond with the foal. But if you've never had a mare foal before, it may, you know, for your comfort levels, be prudent to call a veterinarian out if you can. But the timing is tricky.
I would imagine. We're talking about caring for large animals with Dr. Alexa Burton. She's a clinical assistant professor at UW Veterinary Care Large Animal Hospital. What questions are on your mind? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. And on the show tomorrow at 11, we'll take a look at turtles in Wisconsin and see how they're doing. And then at 11:45, we'll talk about hiking with your dog in Wisconsin parks. That's tomorrow, Thursday, starting at 11 on the Ideas Network. And right now we're talking about large animal veterinary care. If you've got a question or a comment, did you like growing up with large animals? Did you like having a horse? We'd like to hear from you. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Dr. Burton, we did get another email from Angela, and she is wondering about fly boots for horses, and if you have seen these leggings. What are your opinions on these? Do you use them yourself? Also, she says that her horse is very important to her as she stayed home to raise her children. Angela often wonders if her horse helped her through undiagnosed postpartum depression and eased the sense of isolation she was feeling. Horses are certainly a lifeline.
So, Angela, I'm glad that your horse helped you, and I'm sure that he or she did. I'm certain of that. With respect to the leggings, the long leggings that cover the limbs in a mesh, so they were are kind of protective and will keep the flies off. And they're used in England a lot. They're used for horses that suffer particularly badly with allergies to flies or getting bitten by flies more. You know how some people are magnets for mosquitoes. I do feel the same is for horses too. And they're used on the ones that suffer badly. The disadvantages of them are they can slip and fall off, and you may lose them in the field, like, you know, you might lose a bell boot and then you have to buy another one, because it's, unless you've got a very small field of short grass, it'd be quite hard to find it again. And the other thing that I've seen is fly repellent bands, which are just like a little, like the wrist bands you have for people, but they go around the horse's limb. I have not used those myself. I'm not sure that they work. I'm not sure. I have had friends that have used them down in Georgia. I think they do need to be changed out more frequently than it would say on the packet. But they are worth the try as long as they don't get too tight, would be for those fly repellent bands.
Okay, that makes total sense. Thank you for that email, Angela. So we were talking a little bit earlier about the foals and some of the problems that you see there, but what about their mothers? What are some of the problems that mares can have after foaling?
Oh, so the first comment I'd like to make about Wisconsin mares are, yeah, I've worked in England, New York, Canada, Georgia, and Wisconsin mares are the nicest mares that I have worked with.
Just like the people, right?
Yeah, over 2.5 years, they're very, very easy to work with, and that's important because some mares can be very protective to the foal, and that's okay, that's a good thing. But when you're trying to treat one or other of them, either the mother or the foal, if they get upset and try to attack you, or go, you know, as you're trying to treat, it can be very difficult. So onto your question, the problems with the mares are usually relating to not passing their placenta quickly enough. Horses need to pass their placenta quite quickly in comparison to cattle. Otherwise, they can become toxic if they retain it for more than a couple of hours. They need to pass it quickly, and they need to pass it intact. So if there are bits of placenta that are left inside and it's not dealt with lavages and antibiotics, they can become very, very sick, develop laminitis and toxemia. The other problem is lack of milk production, which can happen for a variety of reasons. Sometimes if the mare is sick themselves and they have a foal, but they are not drinking enough, or they have a condition that makes them dehydrated, on top of needing to produce milk for the foal, they will not produce enough milk. There is a drug called domperidone that we can use to help mares produce more milk, and making sure, obviously, they've got fresh water and plenty of feed to make the milk helps. But the domperidone is sometimes necessary in a particular mare might need it every year she foals. That's rare, especially in Wisconsin. But in certain areas, there may be one mare that doesn't produce milk very well unless she has domperidone. You can also use that drug in alpacas as well, if they're not producing milk. But the big one would be relating to not cleansing properly or quickly after they foal, and that leads to knock-on effects of them becoming very sick.
Okay. And are there signs that that's happening that the owner can obviously notice?
Yeah, the signs. So the tricky thing with mares that have just foaled, especially if they have had a few foals before and they're good mothers, is they tend to hide signs of illness more so than if they were on their own, because they are protecting their new baby. And signs to watch for would be an increase in temperature, increase in breathing rate, maybe not wanting to eat as much as they normally would, some signs of colic, an increase in heart rate. But really, any mare that has a foal should have a vet check, you know, the next day, unless you are very, very familiar with foaling, and just to make sure everything's okay. And the placenta should be found and preserved, so a vet can examine it to make sure that it's intact, to make sure that it's all there and there's not a little bit that's been left inside. And that's challenging if they foal out in the field. It's virtually impossible if they foal in the field, which is often, you know, pasture is often a good place for them to foal, to be honest. But, you know, some animal might eat the placenta, or if you've got a large pasture, you may not be able to find it. But that's important too.
And we did get an email from Susan in Baraboo. She's wondering how to introduce grass to a horse that might eat a lot of hay.
Oh, so Susan, good question. Could you elaborate a little bit?
Yeah, it's an email, so I don't have don't have a lot of information.
Grass to a horse that might need a lot of hay.
Apparently, that's what she said, that might eat a lot of hay. So I'm assuming that the horse gets a lot of hay and not as much grass, or maybe it prefers hay to grass. I'm not sure. Go ahead.
I guess there's two scenarios here, possibly. So the first scenario would be, which is less usual, if they've got hay out because the grass is just coming up on the pasture, there's not enough calories in it, they need to have hay out, and they decide to just stick with the hay and not eat the grass. That's less common in my experience, especially in places where there's a period of the year where there's no grass. When the grass comes up, the horses really want it over the hay, even the tiny little shoots. The second scenario would be if it's a horse that's very, very greedy and worried that turning them out onto pasture, they'll suddenly gorge themselves, and that can lead to laminitis or colic.
Okay.
Good way to do that. There are two ways to do it.
And let's save that for when we come back from the news, because it sounds like it's going to have some information in here we want to know. Susan, if you're listening, if you want to give us a little bit more information on that email, that would probably be helpful too. Other than the fact that the horse is a boarding horse, so we do know that. But we're talking about caring for large animals with Dr. Alexa Burton today. Join in. Give us a call, 800-642-1234. We'll be back right after this break for the news. We're talking about caring for large animals on the show today. I'm Jill Nadeau, and this is the Ideas Network. Our guest is Dr. Alexa Burton. She is a clinical assistant professor at UW Veterinary Care Large Animal Hospital. What questions do you have for a large animal vet? What do you want to know about caring for horses, sheep, goats, alpacas, llamas, pigs? We'll take it. Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Burton, we were talking about a problem that Susan in Baraboo was having with her horse and hay, and she is on the line with us, so we can ask her directly. Hi, Susan. Thank you so much for calling.
Hi. Thank you for letting me call in to clarify my question, because it sounded a little goofy the way that it was presented, and that's fine. You guys, you know, are not all horse people. My question is this. In the spring, I mean, my horse is boarded and well cared for. He's in a stable every night, but during the day, in the wintertime, they're out in a lot where they're only fed hay. I understand, and I'm aware of founder and laminitis, because if you introduce them to the spring grass, which has a higher sugar content, then that can cause laminitis. So my question is really just to help me understand is it a certain hours per day? Is it a certain time of year? As far as I know, I don't think that they've been out on grass yet. So if the doctor can please address that. Does that make more sense now?
Excellent. Dr. Burton, do you have any follow-up questions for her?
Yeah, Susan, thank you so much for calling in and clarifying that. You ask a really, really good question and a really important question. And so I've been looking out of my window these last few weeks, and the grass is just going mad out there, as I'm sure you're aware. And so it depends on the type of horse initially. Are they one that's prone to getting laminitis or not? As a general rule of thumb, the thoroughbred types generally don't, and they can have unlimited turnout to grass. They may have some gas colic, but if you have a horse that's a breed that's prone to laminitis, that's an older horse, that's a horse that's overweight in any way, or has had laminitis before, then, you know, there are two ways of doing it. I understand that, you know, you're often constricted by the boarding facility. So you can start with, you know, an hour or two a day. There's a limited amount of grass that they consume within that time period. That said, it is possible for them to eat quite a lot within 2 hours if that's all they're doing, and it's very rich. The other way to do it, especially I would recommend if you have a horse that has had laminitis before, is to use a grazing muzzle initially, because then, you know, one with fleece so it doesn't rub them and ideally stays on, because then you can worry a little bit less about the number of hours, because they are restricted because they can only pick small bits of grass through the muzzle, and therefore they can't guzzle a lot in a short space of time. Another factor that plays into it is, it might sound paradoxical, but horses that are turned out with a lot of others on a large pasture, they do tend to run around a bit to start with, as I'm sure you're aware, especially if they're only allowed out for a few hours a day initially. And so they will spend a proportion of that time playing. Conversely, if they're just with one or two others and it's a smaller area, they'll maybe only play for 5 minutes or less. And so that increases the time that they spend eating. So I don't know if that answers your question directly, but those are the factors you need to consider. And I would strongly recommend getting a grazing muzzle, because then if your horse is prone to laminitis, because then it just slows down their eating initially on this rich spring grass that we're having.
Okay, great. Interesting question. Susan, does that answer your inquiry?
It does, and I have read about grazing muzzles, but I've never used one. But I will say that my breed of horse, which is a full-bred registered Morgan, is one of the breeds that I believe is more susceptible to laminitis. And so I appreciate her input. He's with three other horses. But, one other question. Does working them, lunge lining, you know, making them move more, is that important, or does that not make a difference?
Yeah, no, so that does make a difference. He is a breed that is predisposed, and that's for sure. The fitter they are, the more exercise that they can get, they have a better insulin balance, so they have a better utilization of blood sugar. And it does reduce the risk of laminitis, and it's better to do it. The problem comes if they are laminitic and then you can't work them. But more exercise is always beneficial, because then they can regulate their sugar and their insulin better for now and for the long term. Although it can be challenging to find the time to do that now that we're all back in the office.
Thank you, Susan. We really appreciate you calling to give us all those details. And we did get an email also. A listener couldn't stay with us, but they're wondering if vaccination doses change for miniature horses.
Oh, so that is a really interesting question. And the answer is no, they don't. It is still the same volume for a mini as for a draft. And I've never really known the reason why, but that's how it is. And it's the same, you know, for pigs and for cattle as well. And I believe for cats and dogs. So the dose is the same.
Interesting. Okay, thank you. And we've got Brian on the line, and he's a Menominee. Hi, Brian.
Hello. My question is, it goes back to the battle of, should ruminant animals have corn? Like, we have cattle, we have sheep. We do grain the sheep just for rapid growth and development. We grass feed our cows. What's your opinion on the either?
Okay, thank you, Brian.
So, I'm a big fan of grass feeding cattle. The reason being, in the UK, it's in the summertime when it's not raining and pouring all winter, they are out on pasture, and be they beef or be they dairy. If they're dairy, they come in, they walk in twice a day to be milked, and then they just walk back out again, and they live on the pasture. So the question as to whether they need more than that, it depends if you're planning to show them and if the pasture is 24/7, and then the quality of the pasture too. Because the pasture that they use in England for the dairy cattle, it's sort of like heaven for them. It's very long, it's green, it's lush. They don't really need anything else in the summer.
Okay. Well, thank you for that question, Brian. We've got Bill, and he's in Bayfield County with a question. Hi, Bill.
Hi, thank you. I have half a dozen Nigerian goats and a couple mixed breeds, all small goats. I'm setting up an electric fence to kind of pasture slash use them as brush control. I was asking, my questions are, how long can I leave them out there all day, you know, when I do it? I'm just worried about them overheating. And to add on to that, I was going to ask, what's the best thing to use for tick control?
Oh, okay. So your first question was about leaving them out on the pasture and the brush. Is that right? How long you can leave them out?
Yeah, I'm just worried about them overheating.
Okay. So overeating can be a problem if they are, you probably know this, if they're castrated, they can get, you know, stones, they can become blocked. It depends what type of pasture you've got. If it's quite rough and there's a lot of browse, then, you know, and branches, then that's good for goats in particular. They can, you know, go out and browse, and there isn't really too long. If there's not that much scrub, if it's more of a classical green grass pasture, then you could run into problems with them overeating. And what was your second question again?
What to worry about for tick control, because the wood ticks are pretty heavy up here.
Yeah, that's so for tick control, you know, that's a tricky one. I really don't have, you can use, you know, tick competitors, but the things that are effective, that are legal, it's challenging, and you can't necessarily pick ticks off every single animal. So it's more about vaccinating against the diseases that ticks might bring, because there are products that you can slather animals with that will reduce ticks, but even those don't stop them completely. So thinking from the horse standpoint, you still have to, you know, bring your horse in and remove ticks, or even you take your dog on a walk, you have to remove a tick, and that's not necessarily practical with a herd. And so it's more about making sure that they're vaccinated against with the 5-way or 7-way.
Okay, thanks for that call. So we were talking about some, you know, like large animals like goats and sheep or pigs, or they can actually be pets. What should somebody be looking for or know before they go out and buy themselves like a teacup pig or a little miniature goat? I mean, it seems so cute and fun, but there are still, you know, animals that need to be taken care of. So what do they really need to ask themselves before they do that?
So that's a super, super question. And it particularly pertains to the pigs, because number one, the teacup pigs, the true teacup pigs are quite rare. And unfortunately, there are unscrupulous breeders who will give misinformation about the piglet's age, claiming they're a teacup piglet, when really they're just a small mini pig. That said, any pig will grow so much bigger than their initial, like, cute little 3 or 4 pound starting size. They can end up 300 pounds. They have extreme, so the Vietnamese pigs, mini pigs, teacup pigs, can have particular problems with obesity. And to me, it is startling how little they need to eat. And they still, it's their breed nature, designed to conserve energy. But they become overweight very easily, and it can lead to a host of problems such as arthritis. And you have a giant, then a much bigger animal than you started with, rather like a puppy for Christmas of a breed that you don't really know. The other factor with pigs is they're very, very intelligent. And along with that intelligence can come, if they're not managed and trained properly, aggression. And they do have tusks and teeth. And so if you don't respect them and train them as you would a dog, like a German Shepherd or something, a dog like that, they can be dangerous and they can bite and really become a problem. So there's the space and their size and then the aggression. But they, if you're prepared for all of that, they are intelligent and friendly animals. And indoor and outdoor is usually best, rather than exclusively indoor or exclusively outdoor would be good too if you have the space. With the goats and the sheep for pets, the biggest thing is making sure that you have the space and the knowledge about what they'll need to start with, because they have very specific requirements. Goats need a lot of browse and probably more space than you'd anticipate. I'd say a pet goat is probably easier than a pet pig if it's legal to keep goats where you live and you have the space for them.
Okay, well, that's good information, because I know it always seems like a good idea until the reality sets in. Yeah. So think twice about doing that. As far as their care and health, is it better? Are they more susceptible to things, these miniaturized versions of the larger animals?
Yeah, they can be more susceptible to joint problems, joint deformity, as you know, they're miniature. It's not quite as far as, for example, the dogs that have, you know, bulldogs or pug dogs who can have extreme problems breathing. But you know, miniature pigs can have problems with their joints, and occasionally congenital heart abnormalities. And then the miniature goats, the main problem with them, there are quite a lot of them around, and the main issue is them becoming overweight and blocked if they're a male, which will require surgery many times. In many cases will require surgery. So that would be their propensity to become overweight.
And with summer coming up, what kind of tips do you have for people who have larger animals about, you know, the heat, the humidity? We talked a little bit about parasites and whatnot, but what do owners really need to remember during the summer months?
So it sounds really simple, but you know, clean, fresh water and a salt block. A salt block is essential, because if it's a very hot, humid day, you can have animals that are losing water or needing more water and needing more salt and electrolytes when they're doing nothing, they're just standing outside. And another thing to consider would be having them out at night when it's cooler and in during the day. That's what they do in the southern states, like Georgia, they switch over. And even on the East Coast, they switch over to having them out at night and in during the day, because the shade from the sun is very helpful. And then fans, just basic fans inside can be really helpful for airflow. So water, salt block, fans. And that would be the big tips. And if you have a, before I forget, if you have a horse that has a pink nose or is white all along their back, you may need to put sunscreen because they can get burned. It's not too common up here, but if it's blazing sun, they can get sunburned.
I guess I wouldn't have thought about that. Well, is there a special kind of sunscreen for horses or just the stuff we use?
Oh, just the stuff we use is fine. And for the pigs too.
Okay. Yeah. And I know one of your specialties is geriatric equine horse care. There's some special needs for the older horses during the summer or in general, I guess. And when do you consider a horse to be quote unquote old?
Oh, that's a great question. When you consider them to be old, I'd say 20 years ago, 20 was old. Now 30 is the new 20 for
wow.
horses. And so they're living longer and longer. And the big thing for old horses is competition. So making sure they don't have competition for shade, water, food, and a steady companion group, because they become very increasingly attached to their friends. And so make sure they don't have competition and make sure that they have a stable friend group.
So with a horse that's being boarded, I would assume then it's a lot more important for them to stay in the same stable as they get older?
It's the most important thing is staying with their peers, so their friends. So it doesn't necessarily need to be the same stable, but they can get very upset if they are not near their best friends. My horse, she was 29 and a half when she passed away. And I was very, very lucky with her because she was like the popular girl in school. And if one of her friends moved away or deceased, she made a new friend within 12 hours.
Wow.
Or if a new horse came, she'd make a new friend. She was very good at making friends. And so very, very lucky in that respect. But a lot of older horses are very fixed and attached to their specific friends.
Great. Well, this has been so enjoyable speaking with you, Dr. Burton. We really appreciate it. I learned so much, and I've been around horses for a long time. So thank you so much for being with us, and hopefully we'll get you back again next year.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. We've been talking with Dr. Alexa Burton. She is a clinical assistant professor at UW Veterinary Care Large Animal Hospital. Join us again tomorrow when we talk about turtles in Wisconsin. And then at 11:45, we'll talk about hiking with your dog in Wisconsin parks. I'm Jill Nadeau, in for Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for listening to the Ideas Network. Stay well.